Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017. A pleasure to have you all here. If any of you came for the work session on Senate Bill 3, that has been removed from the agenda. That's the bill related to suction dredge mining. And we're hoping that we'll have an amendment ready very soon, within the next day or two, and we'll post that. And our plan is to have the work session on Monday. Okay. So we have two bills then to have public hearings on, Senate Bill 500 and Senate Bill 892. And we're going to start in reverse, we're going to do it in reverse order. We're going to start with Senate Bill 892 and then do 500. So, Beth, I'm going to go down and present on this bill, and if you could let people know what it is, that would be great.
I'm going to open the public hearing.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
Okay, so I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 892.
That was my job. Typically, the only thing I get to do.
No, you get to hold them in order of contempt, right? You still got the gavel, man.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 892 would direct the Oregon Department of Forestry to maintain an electronic reporting and notification system and also requires an operator, timber owner, or landowner to file a notice of a proposed aerial pesticide application using that electronic system. There is no subsequent referral on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. So during my earlier stint as chair of this committee, I became aware of the serious concerns that many Oregonians have about aerial application of pesticides on forest lands.
Michael?
Yes. Yeah, oh, I'm sorry, of course. During my earlier stint, when I was first chair, Michael Dembro, representing Senate District 23 here in the Oregon Senate.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. So I became aware of the serious concerns that many Oregonians have about aerial application of pesticides on forest lands and their fear of being the victims of misapplication. The specific misapplication that made me aware of the problem was a notorious incident in Curry County that many of you will remember. That ultimately proved to be a case of misconduct, serious misconduct on the part of the applicator. We heard from a number of local residents who were harmed by this misconduct, some really terrible stories. Anytime aerial pesticide drifts into a neighbor's property, that's a misapplication and a cause of concern. Neighbors legitimately fear that the application nearby will harm their children, their pets, or they themselves. Applicators may say they have no reason to fear, but I would argue that their concern is real and it is legitimate. If an application is scheduled to occur, they should know that and be able to plan for it, taking whatever steps they feel are necessary to make sure that their children and pets are kept indoors or kept safely away from the property. Ideally, people should be able to receive notification just before the application was going to happen, allowing them to make these plans. In an ideal world, they would receive a phone call or a knock on the door or a leaflet when an application was about to happen, or, as often occurs, reschedule due to weather or other problems. Some timber owners have a practice of doing this, but most do not. And expecting them all to do this kind of personal contact every time would be too much to ask. But in reality, we're not limited to doing things the old-fashioned way. Thanks to improvements in technology, we have a pathway to providing Oregonians with the notification that many of them desire, while not putting an undue burden on owners and operators. The Department of Forestry's new electronic ferns system is that pathway, and Senate Bill 892, as amended, will allow us to utilize this technology to give neighbors and visitors to state parks the notification that they need. We did not have that technology in 2015, but we do now. I've been following the development of ferns over the last couple of years and talking about it with the good people at the Department of Forestry. Ferns is designed to collect the information that is already required of landowners, operators, and applicators, and made available to the public through a paid paper subscriber service currently. Ferns will remove the cost, and it will provide the electronic access. I believe that Ferns will soon be ready to provide the real-time notification that many Oregonians desire, while doing so with minimal impact on forestry owners and operators. While the department must, of course, remain neutral on the policy behind Senate Bill 892, I believe that you'll hear from them the details on how Ferns is ready to accomplish these goals. We've drafted Senate Bill 892 to be as close to the existing ORS 527.670 and current Board of Forestry rules to make it easier for industry to adopt the requirements of the bill. The Dash 2 amendments seek to address some of the concerns that we heard from industry. The landowner, operator, or applicator will file their written plan for an operation with the same information currently in rule. The notification to the department will include the planned date of the operation. The information will be posted on the Ferns service, on the Ferns system, and made available to all those who have subscribed to the Ferns service. Then, within 5 days after the operation has been completed, the report on the application, which the operator is currently required to complete, must be submitted to the department. This will also be submitted electronically by scan or photograph or whatever is easiest for the operator. In an ideal world, the operation will always occur on the anticipated date. And in many cases, they will be able to do the operation on the planned date. But we don't live in an ideal world, and in other cases, they will not. Weather, equipment issues, illness can interfere with the best laid plans. We heard a lot of concern from industry about that. So the bill provides a 5-day window for them to do the operation without having to notify the department of any changes. They can do it 2 days before the planned date or 2 days after the planned date. If that window doesn't work out, they can submit a new date via Ferns or simply call the department or their forest steward contact. That new information will then go up on Ferns to keep the neighbors up to speed. Or if the decision is made to cancel the operation entirely, that information will also be communicated as it currently is and posted. Colleagues, we've heard in the past, and you will hear again, why this kind of transparency and timely notification is important to people. However you feel about the necessity of pesticide use in our forest land, we all have a shared commitment, I believe, to keeping people healthy, safe, and free from worry. Colleagues, you do not see an emergency clause on this bill because we want to give landowners a lot of lead time to prepare for these modest changes. The operative date for the new system is September 1st, 2018, more than a year after what I hope will be the passage of this sensible bill. And I am more than available to answer any questions you might have about the bill or the intentions of the bill.
Are there any questions? I have one. Thank you.
Yes.
Which is my prerogative, I guess. In the original bill, if I may, it said the boundaries of the proposed aerial application, and then you changed it in the amendment to the legal description. Then further down, you say if the boundaries of the proposed application area change after notice is filed. Now, would that be the same boundaries as the legal description?
I'm not, that may be a question for the department. We tried to write this language so that it's the same as their current rules.
Okay.
So if you could hold off on that. And, you know, I didn't make one point that I should have. In the original bill, you'll see a reference to this applying to private forest land. But we changed that because this does not just apply to private forest land. It also applies to state forest land. It doesn't apply to federal forest land for various reasons, including the fact that they're currently not spraying, but also for jurisdictional reasons. So this applies to private forest land and state-owned forest land.
So I guess I get to follow up my own question, and you're saying that those questions could be answered by the forestry department?
Yes.
Rather than you? Okay.
I think so.
Yes, Senator Roblin.
So aerial application is an expensive thing. There are a lot of requirements around it right now with regard to they can't have overspray. If they do, there has to be a report filed, and they are responsible for anything that gets outside of their boundary. If I have, I come to a site and I planned it, I've got a number of plans, and they might be 20 or 30 miles apart, different places. And I come, and the wind is blowing too high here, but you got to report that it's okay at the other place. So I can fly over and finish up a job that I wasn't doing before. So would I have to apply and put it on ferns for all of the jobs that could possibly happen on that day and then redo it each time the wind changed or whatever so that I could use the helicopter at the time that I have it as opposed to waiting and putting it one after
yes.
another and not being able to
mm-hmm.
plan as well?
Right. That's why we created this five-day window, you know, because that operation 30 miles away would most likely have been, you know, on the schedule, maybe not for that day, but somewhere around that time. And so they could just do that where the weather is good, and then the next day, if the weather is good, go back to the, you know, the original one. And if it's not good, they could do it the next day. Or, you know, that's why we have this five-day window. And again, if they have to change, all it takes is a phone call or, you know, if they're more comfortable just doing it online, doing it that way.
Can I follow up?
Sure, certainly, please.
So I thought that's kind of what ferns was designed to do already. So why is the need for this particular bill when it's going to happen when it gets finished?
Currently, I believe that what I believe is missing under the, you know, the current system is identifying the precise day in which the operation will occur or is intended to occur. I think right now the fern system gives a very long open window for where the operation could occur, up to a year is my understanding. And so this narrows it down to a point that can be useful to neighbors. I mean, if you know that there's going to be an application within a year, that's not very useful to neighbors, right?
I have a further question. If there's no, Senator Burchard?
No, I don't think so.
Senator Przanski?
Not yet.
Okay. In your, and your, I know what you're going to tell me the answer is, but I'm going to ask you anyhow. In your amendment, once again, we talked about the legal description of the property. Then we talked about the boundaries. But then it goes back to, they need to provide the air temperature, the relative humidity, the wind velocity, and wind direction measured within the forest operation area hourly during the application. And then you go back to another legal description of the actual application area. Now, if the legal description of the property, if it's 1,000 acres and they only do 4 acres, that which would not have a legal description for that 4 acres because you're talking boundaries before, how do you ascertain that or make a differential determination of the area? Because if you talked about a legal description, that might go near a home, but if they're 3 miles away and it's the same piece of property, I just wonder how you would.
Yes. And again, I asked to have this written in a way that complied with the existing rules. So that's the intention.
Okay.
And you can hear from the department if that's not the case. But I think that was the goal, to make it identical to the existing rules so that there would be as little change in procedure as possible.
Who's next?
Somebody starts with this.
Could we have, please?
Hold it, wait.
You're doing it?
Yeah. Oh. Sorry.
You didn't go that far away.
Man, oh man.
You got to act quick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You wanted to close to that already? I can't do it. No.
Yeah, I want to hear from some of the people. So can we have Lori Bernstein, Nancy Webster, and James Aldridge, please. Okay, whoever would like to start, please.
I'll start. Good afternoon. My name is Lori Bernstein. I'm a retired biologist with the Forest Service. And I like to organize like to use my skills now to help organizations display data on maps like the ones I'll be showing you today. I am reading this testimony on behalf of Chris Rush, who could not be here, and we are both in support of Senate Bill 892. The main point to make here is that spraying herbicides from helicopters is dangerous, and people who live near these areas where helicopter spraying occurs needs to be warned in advance. I am here to talk to you about a pesticide drift incident that impacted residents outside of Tiller, Oregon in 2014. As you can see on the slide here, Tiller is southeast of Oregon, southeast of Roseburg, located in Douglas County. The spray occurred on a harvested tract of private timber land. Three chemicals were sprayed by helicopter to kill unwanted vegetation. The chemicals were atrazine, clopyrrolid, and hexazinone, all of which are toxic and harmful to humans. On April 16, 2014, a helicopter was aerially spraying on Seneca Jones timberland. The clear-cut unit being sprayed is approximately 100 to 600 yards away from six separate residents. During this spraying event, some residents were outside doing yard work. They started to experience a host of symptoms listed here on the slide. Several of the residents who declined to report their symptoms to the regulatory agency due to fear of local retribution also experienced vomiting, headaches, burning eyes, and a bad taste in their mouth. Shortly after symptoms began, residents contacted the Seneca Jones Company. A company forester assured everyone that Seneca had a forester on site performing tests and all conditions were perfect for an aerial spray that day. The residents reported to the forester that there was a visible gray mist in the air drifting over Jackson Creek and onto residential property, and that residents were experiencing adverse health effects. Following these complaints, a regulatory investigation was initiated by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The investigation showed that on a day when the forester determined that conditions were good for spraying, herbicides did drift off-site. The agency found the herbicides had drifted within the protected riparian buffer and across Jackson Creek into onto residential property. And that report is attached to my testimony. The state's case file shows the company appears to have followed the rules meant to prevent drift. However, chemicals left the target site and people got sick. This example shows that a legal application can take place and pesticide drift can still harm residents. Seneca was not found to be in violation of the law, but harm was done. This happened to be a reported case, but what about all the cases where people don't report? These rural residents deserved advance warning. Some timber companies will tell you that they want to be good neighbors and provide notification on a voluntary basis. Other companies are not willing to work closely with their nearby neighbors. Voluntary notification is not dependable, and rural residents should not be left guessing whether the timber company will contact them. This is a documented example of why every rural resident across Oregon should have the right to know when an aerial spray will occur and exactly what will be sprayed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bernstein. Nancy, do you want to?
Hi, and my Bob has my visual exhibit here. Hi, my name is Nancy Webster, and I reside in Rockaway Beach. I grew up on the Oregon coast, actually North Bend, near where Senator Roblin is from, and my father and my relatives were all employed in either logging, millwork, or my father was a lumber grader. And as a family, we loved picking berries, going clam digging. So when I retired in 2009, I was able to move back to the coast to Rockaway Beach. And in about 2012, I looked up from our porch, and across the street, I could see up across 101, massive clear cutting happening, steep, steep slopes. So I hiked in there with my friend, who's a retired DEQ water quality tester. We were overwhelmed by the amount of clear cutting we saw. The headwaters were cut. We then ran into two local contract loggers, and they said, hey, this is your watershed. You have some of the best drinking water around. We're concerned about what this type of logging is doing to your watershed. And then they said, and they'll aerial spray. You need to go and talk to ODF. My friend Judy and I were just shocked that this was our watershed, is our watershed, and that they would aerial spray. It was later that year in 2012, I was down on the beach and I looked up and they were aerial spraying the headland, the front of the watershed across about a half mile as a crow flies from my house. I could smell the spray. So then I started trying to find out, well, what did they spray? I called ODF, they could not tell me. I called the city manager, Public Works, the water master, they did not know what was sprayed. They said you could call the local private forester. I called him and he said, well, it's public knowledge, this is what I sprayed. And it was a combination cocktail of chemicals. And I said, well, can we work with you? Because this is our drinking water. And he says, this is industrial forest being traded on Wall Street. Our responsibilities is to Wall Street. And he was honest. So then I went on and we talked with neighbors. And in 2013, I learned that this was 1,400 acre watershed owned by two private companies. One was Olympic Resource Management, the other was Stimson. And irony is Olympic Resource Management is part of Pope and Talbot, where my father worked in the late 40s. So then I started realizing it wasn't just our watershed that they were spraying. The Rockaway track goes from Jetty Creek all the way to Garibaldi. And in that area, the municipal boundaries, neighborhoods, border the industrial timberland. And so when they spray, they're spraying right up to those boundaries. And we had some success talking to the private landowners about, notification. And we worked out, like, this area, there's campgrounds, there's schools, there's churches, all within bordering or close to. And we had one timber company was willing to call me and notify me, but that left me the responsibility of trying to tell everyone, which didn't work very well. And there was a few other instances of them telling, some local residents who had requested it. It does not work. And when they do, one August 2015, I was standing down there picking up the Oregonian in Rockaway, and I looked. And the helicopter, it was a Sunday morning, there was a lot of tourists, it was packed in Rockaway. The helicopter was spraying right above the municipal boundary there. And people, there's no effective, the system does not work for people finding out what is happening. It is broken. And the Oregon Health Authority and DEQ said your biggest risk of exposure is the air you breathe. There are no air monitors available. We do not know how much we are breathing. And then because of lack of notification, DEQ is not able to test because they don't know from ODF when those sprays are going to happen. So we were one time able to arrange testing on Jetty Creek connected in 2013 with the sprays, and one of the chemicals did show up in our water. The amount we don't know, but there's really no testing, air or water. And this is the water we drink. They spray the headwaters. This is the, you know, the air and the municipalities. I think the least we can do is provide notification for people. It is possible through FERN. I mean, the churches and now and communities are able to alert people about garage sales and different things coming up on these alert systems. This is the new age. People can notify people. So I'm really hoping that we can have notification. People worry. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nancy. Mr. Aldridge. Oh, could you put the mic by?
Oh. My name's James Aldridge, and I was part of the Cedar Valley spray. I have been a logger all my life. I was an engineer for 27 years. I believe this is important because this happened to me. It taken my life, and it's made me sick. I think this bill needs to be passed for a few reasons. Verbal don't work. I had a verbal agreement with the landowner and the land management people. I personally logged up behind my house for the company I was working for, and they were going to let us know before they burnt and before they sprayed. For the fact I asked, my wife had a liver transplant, so they were going to let us know. They did not let us know before they burnt, and I got a hold of them and said, hey, how do I get notified before you guys do this aerial application? We will call you, Mr. Aldridge. Cool. They never called us. We never knew exactly where they were going to spray this. You could smell it when I got home from work. I drank this stuff. I put it in my hot tub because I have surface water, and I got deathly ill from this chemical. I believe that they ought to put this stuff online and notify and make you aware of the substance that they're spraying around your place. For the fact, I probably wouldn't be in the position. I'm taking IV treatment, I'm taking methotrexate as a chemo, I'm taking other medicines to clean up my blood and to get me back living again. I think this is a very important bill. I drove up here from Gold Beach to stand up for this. It's not that it's too much to ask. I really don't think so. And a 5-day window, I think that is, you know, I've lived on the coast all my life. I logged, big machines and everything. It is a very simple thing to do in a 5-day window period. I would appreciate if you guys would really consider this bill. I've lost animals. I lost fruit trees. I almost lost myself. My wife had stents put in her liver here not very long ago, and they said they'd never seen a person have an issue after having a transplant this many years down the line. They didn't say exactly what it's from. We put two and two together, people, and we know why. So I'm asking you guys to really consider this bill. I don't think it's out of hand at all.
Thank you, Mr. Aldridge. Thanks for coming all this way.
I appreciate you guys.
Colleagues, any questions? Yes, Senator Rogan.
In the Cedar Valley one, would you have been looking, because the actual place they were supposed to spray wasn't really that close to your house, was it?
They were staging that helicopter.
Yeah, exactly.
Right around.
No, I knew where they staged it, and I knew where it dropped because it was definitely because you came to our up and talked to our as our office. But I'm wondering, okay, since it's staged there, you probably would have looked at ferns. I'm just trying to figure out, in your case, there was no application going to really be near your house. Should not have been any near your house, right?
Yeah, but it was all over the windows of my.
Oh, I'm not saying it wasn't there. I'm because they got fined for that. I mean, it was truly a. Mm-hmm. It was really a bad situation where people got sprayed on places that weren't even in the area of the actual deal. So that's the concern that I have in this one. But, yeah, I just want people to know that it wasn't because it was drift from other from what your experience is, you're saying it got dropped on you, just like it, yeah. Yeah.
It was a...
Yeah, no, I would say that it's not clear that Fern's notification could have handled that right. situation.
He could have looked around at Fern's, though, yeah. and found that he wanted to, that it was happening. And
right.
he knew where the staging area
and
was.
And I could have stayed at my parents' house right. or right. my kids' house, yeah. you know, if I knew this was going to go. I could have got my animals out of there. I lost a 18-month-old paper German Shepherd dog, and they said it had ingested some poison. You know, we did an autopsy. It died at the hospital. We lost two wiener dogs. I lost my fruit. I haven't ate it since. I'm getting ready to again, I hope. But
yeah.
I think this would be helpful.
Right.
This one also helped with making sure that people go and investigate faster, because it was a long time later that that
It took me over 7 months to find yeah. out the chemicals sprayed around there. And I believe if I could have found out fairly quick, they could have dealt with it.
And there were no samples taken because it was way too late by yep. the time everybody got involved.
Correct.
In we've tried to work that out with OHA and stuff and others.
We've made some changes. And we talked about making the change that's proposed in this bill, but the technology just wasn't there back yeah. then. Okay, thank you all very much.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, I'm going to call... thanks. I'm going to call up some organizational people now. Scott Dahlman, Barry Bashu, and Heath Curtis, please. Is Barry here? Great, thanks. And just in case you have some difficulties figuring it out, we'll be doing panels of pro, con, as far as the bills go.
Great, thank you. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Dahlman, Policy Director for Oregonians for Food and Shelter. As a reminder, we represent farmers, foresters, and other users of pesticides, fertilizer, and biotechnology, speaking here today in opposition to Senate Bill 892. I've submitted extensive written comments, which are in the record, so I'll keep it brief for you all today. You will hear from experts that follow me today who do this work every day on why this bill is unworkable. But I would like to highlight one letter that I think is in the testimony from a member of OFS named Paul Washburn. I think it highlights the difficulty with this. Paul is down. He helps organize aerial applications, and he is down on the South Beach right now area, and he has been there since Thursday. And as of last night, he still did not know today what units he was going to be able to spray or not. He had intended to be here to testify on the work he does, but as of last night, it was a 50-50 shot today whether they were going to get out and what units it would be. And he's got 70-plus units that they're going to be applying to over the next month. So it is very difficult for them to be able to predict. But that aside, that letter's in there for you guys to see. I'd like to take you guys on a little trip down memory lane all the way back to 2015. After hearings on a series of pesticide bills, two work groups were formed in 2015 to look at issues around pesticides. What came out of that work was a robust package of reforms. And I'd like to remind you what some of those were that have gone into effect, because we think it's really important to remember the work that's already been done. The first thing was codifying 60-foot buffers around dwellings or schools for forestry aerial applications. So now 60-foot buffers, they went into effect in January 1st of 2016. There's also a new requirement for aerial applicators to obtain a separate aerial applicator license. It requires 50 hours of aerial training, a national test, and ongoing education requirements for anybody making aerial applications. A significant investment in new investigators, case reviewers, administrative help, and laboratory capacity at Oregon Department of Agriculture in their Pesticide Investigation Division. Since then, ODA has hired four new investigators and a citizen advocate. We have also created a dedicated hotline for people to call who are concerned that they or their property have been exposed to pesticides. Concerned citizens can now call the 211 line and get information about how to file a complaint or more information if they're looking for it, if they're concerned. The good news is that we did a public records request with the Department of Agriculture to find out about what complaints have come in over the last couple of years. Complaints are actually up in 2016. We think that's attributable to the work that's been done on outreach and helping people to be able to file concerns easier. But I would also point out that the good news that comes with that is, as of now, there have been zero violations related to the aerial application of pesticides in forestry for the year 2016. In fact, if you look at the data, which I have included with my testimony, from 2011 through 2016, there were only four violations issued by ODA for forestry aerial applications. And for the record, one of those did include for the application that happened in Tiller, Oregon. Also, there was an increase in pesticide registration fees, an actual doubling is paid. This additional revenue was used to help fund the new ODA positions and that hotline. This was something we were very supportive of in 2015. We've also doubled the civil penalties associated with pesticide violations. And lastly, but definitely not least, we worked on the updates for the ODF Forestry Activity Electronic Reporting and Notification System, affectionately known as FERNS, to provide a no-cost public portal with access to the forestry activity notifications that are already being filed through that system. It was a $1.5 million investment in that program, with nearly $560,000 of that coming from industry. We are supportive of these things. It's not up and running yet. It is scheduled. I'm sure Department of Forestry can give you a more accurate date, but it's scheduled to be rolled out in April of this year, and that will go online. And so what we're saying is, we've made this new investment. Let's get that up and running and then see if there continues to be issues, and at that time, take a look at it again. So the bottom line is, we have strong pesticide laws in place. Pesticide drift is illegal. Please oppose this bill.
Thank you, Scott. Heath?
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and we're here in opposition to the bill. I signed up at the end of the list in anticipation that I would be summarizing statements made by speakers before me and reiterating them for you. But now that I'm at the head of the list, maybe I'll introduce some of those concepts that you'll hear this afternoon. Oregon's had pesticide use reporting in the past, and that evidence for forestry that approximately 4% of the total pesticides used in Oregon were used in forestry. As Scott just mentioned, you've seen that notwithstanding a 211 line and increased focus and attention on forestry, we've actually produced zero violations in the aerial forestry pesticide application arena in the last year. So the question you have to ask yourself is, if you're going to impose on landowners a new, expensive, and burdensome notice and reporting system, the question is what's the problem you're trying to solve? We would propose to you that there is no problem, and I think that you're going to hear a lot of people come up here this afternoon and tell you how proud they are about their operations, what they do, the degree to which this practice is regulated already, and the fact that what you're proposing would be very expensive and very difficult to implement, not only from the large landowner perspective, but maybe even more precisely for the smaller landowner perspective. So with all of that, I guess my ask to you is, before passing new legislation, please define for yourself very crisply what you think the problem is. If it's one of perception, then I would propose to you that the utility of a program like this may be very little. There will still be pesticide applications, and there will still be that perception. So with that, thanks for my testimony, and please vote no on the bill.
Thank you. Very welcome.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. On behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, my name is Barry Bichoux, by the way. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 892. Hundreds of Farm Bureau members own and manage timberland throughout this state. Senate Bill 892 would dramatically hinder their ability to control invasive and noxious weeds on their private property and to raise productive forests and crops. Senate Bill 892 creates specific notice requirements, including exact date and location for forestry pesticide applications, creating a requirement that a landowner must list a specific date for application that is no less than 7 days ahead is gambling with Mother Nature. To ensure accuracy and safety, applications must occur when weather conditions are optimal and under the wind requirement on the pesticide product labels. Senate Bill 892 puts landowners' operations at the whim of a guess. Farm Bureau is extremely concerned with the precedent this bill sets for all applicators to notify before application. The issues with unpredictable weather are the same for agricultural operations as they are for forestry. The legislation also requires reporting within 2 business days specific information related to the application, including the landowner, the applicator, the product, including quantity and rate, the date, time and conditions of the application, weather condition, and location of the application. Farm Bureau opposes this version of pesticide use reporting. In 1999, the Oregon legislature passed with Farm Bureau support legislation creating a pesticide use reporting system, the other PERS. The legislation required the information submitted be done in a manner that personal information related to an applicant's location or the applicator's business could be kept private for their personal safety. I served on that advisory committee board that actually included Brad Witt, now State Representative, House District 31 from Clatskanie, that developed the administrative rules and guiding policies. Senate Bill 892 is in direct opposition of the hours and investment of our work. The resultant legislation was a model of collaboration and bipartisan effort to create the current, albeit unfunded, reporting system. It was a legislative decision to defund and pause the PERS program. I can't speak for the reasons why, but clearly there didn't seem to be a need for it to be a priority. That program was defunded by the legislature in 2007. In 2009, through a process initiated by Representative Brian Clem, stakeholders agreed to extend the sunset for the PERS program. These stakeholders, including Oregonians for Food and Shelter, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides, and the Oregon Environmental Council, all of those agreed to initiate no efforts that would further alter the substance of the PERS system until the law comes under review in 2019. I think you'll see by the list that it's relatively diverse, probably not a lot of Christmas cards being shared, but there was a collaborative effort that came to fruition in 2009. I'm concerned about reinventing an already well thought out and workable wheel with more expenses and without the kind of broad-based support that culminated in our current system. I would hope that if the legislature believes that pesticide use reporting is a necessity, they would fund the existing statute in favor of funding a new system. There is no question that the reporting requirements in Senate Bill 892 are a rework of the pesticide use reporting system. They may come under a different name and be limited now to only one of the segments of our proud industry, but this legislation is unacceptable under the 2009 agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. And just to clarify, under the amendments, that reporting period is extended to 5 days, and everything in it, you know, the intention is that it's current practice.
And Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, I appreciate that clarification, but again, that extra 2 days on either side of it really doesn't solve the kind of weather problems that we face in agriculture and in forestry.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more for clarification based on what the Dash 2s do, and it's probably more for staff or yourself, Mr. Chair. Date certain, location, owner, it sounds like, is what has to be reported at the end of the, I guess, on the second reporting after the application, is the location and the owner. If, let's say, that 5 day period, they're not able to get the spraying done because of weather, how quickly can they modify their initial notice saying we're going to now apply like the next 5 days after the first 5 runs? Is there a time certain that it has to be posted before they can actually do the application?
I believe not. There was, I think in the original bill as introduced, there potentially could have been,
But now, if they need to reschedule outside of that five-day window, they can do that.
Okay.
And Chair Dimbro, Senator Przanski, I think that's correct. That is to say, the way the bill is redrafted in the dash twos, you can notify the state forester of a new proposed date, provided that it's within the initial notification window. Notice, however, that there's very few operators that actually conduct this activity, and I think some of the people behind me are going to speak to the practicality of doing that. When you have to renotice for one, that adds labor for the subsequent following days, right? And what happens there is, if you are going to cap out on the subsequent days on the number of units that you can do, that cascades into the next day and into the next day. That is to say, just by creating two extra days to get that work done, you're not necessarily solving the problem that you may actually have to re-notify on all of your units just by virtue of missing a single day. And so some of that will come up later, but there are challenges in implementation. I actually believe you're correct, Senator, that technologically, from the Department of Forestry's perspective, there's a path to making it that you can check boxes. That's actually true, and I dispute the fact that this wasn't available in 2015. What I think you will find, however, though, is that it's difficult to implement on the ground.
Okay, thanks. And we'll hear from some applicators. Thank you very, very much, gentlemen. Okay, let me get these people first. Okay. Let's have Gary Hale, Ellen Sanders, and Misty Frost, please. Did I say Sanders? Saunders. Okay, whoever wants to start. Okay, could you pull the mic over to you? Great. And if you could just start by saying your name for the
record. My name is Gary Hale. I live in the Coast Range of Oregon. There seems to be a misunderstanding, because today there is a danger that helicopters will spray unknown chemicals with unknown dangers near homes of Oregonians, with no warning or recourse available to them. Senator Rublin, I live in your district near Triangle Lake. I took part in the Triangle Lake pesticide study. Pesticides were found in my urine, my son's urine, and my wife's urine, even though we live on an organic farm in the Coast Range. Comparable amounts of atrazine and 2,4-D were found in all our urine. We lived about 5 miles from the nearest recently sprayed clear cuts. We're well aware of that because I disperse notifications to neighbors. I also, I also inform people of notifications in the Eugene area through the Eugene Weekly newspaper. While I drank water from a spring on a hill near our home, my wife and our son drank bottled water from Eastern Oregon, yet we all had similar urine test results. The long distance, our pure food, we had no personal use of pesticides, and our different water sources point to pesticide drift as the source of exposure. Pesticides sprayed on forests in Western Oregon are subject to mixing and dispersal by strong diurnal air flows caused by gusty winds in very steep valleys common in the Coast Range. Pesticide drift modeling used for risk assessment by the EPA is based on low-level flights, typically 10 feet above the ground in still air in Texas, on flat ground in still air in Texas, not the uneven terrain found in the Coast Range. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hale.
Hello, my name is Ellen Saunders. I live on Dingheiser Road. That's 47950 Northwest Dingheiser Road in Manning, Oregon. I ask that you support both SB 892 and SB 500. I ask because I live in the Coast Range Mountains west of Banks, Oregon, in timber area now owned by Weyerhaeuser, the treatment of that timber property is very different than it has been. I have submitted several pieces of information for all of you, but I'd like to make a few comments. Mike Appleby is a neighbor of ours, and as you may be aware, he has been fined and had his license revoked for a year. We had hoped that it would be revoked for 5 years. That's for spraying. The Department of Agriculture had a very lengthy and complicated issue. He sprayed the Weyerhaeuser property that is adjacent to our community some years back, and most of us ended up being sick in one way or another. I run an organic orchard and an organic garden specifically so that I do not have to deal with pesticides. I also only buy organic. And the fact of the matter is we know that 2,4-D, atrazine, and Roundup, various forms of glyphosate, are toxic. We know that because we have the World Health Organization saying so, and we now have California's issuing warnings of these chemicals being carcinogenic. One of the things that I have submitted is 60 pages of a California UC Davis report on the chemical complications that people suffer from having these chemicals in the air. So at the very least, we need to know when these things are coming. On top of that, I also supported bigger buffers, 60 feet. How long is this room? Would you guess? Certainly not more than 60 feet. Is just absolutely no buffer at all. And so when these planes come in and fly through this area and the wind drift blows it off of the land, it also lands on the ground and then it rises with the mist. So we're not just dealing with the immediate spray issue, we're dealing with the ongoing public contamination. I am really concerned that we not only support these measures, but that we eventually look to finding other ways. I've raised fir trees on my property. I can't even begin to tell you how fast they grow. And most of you know that. If you've spent any time in the Coast Range, they don't need pesticides to support them. We don't need these toxics. We really don't. But we are destroying our wildlife, our watersheds. We are destroying all of the capacity of our intestinal tract with the biome to actually take care of good health. So we're dealing with not just a health issue. We are dealing with creating cancers and creating Crohn's disease and creating psoriasis and eczema. These toxic chemicals must be at the very least limited and acknowledged, and we must know when they're being sprayed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Saunders, and thank you for submitting all that testimony. I had hopes for my weekend, but you've destroyed them.
Thank you.
Misty Frost, please.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Misty Frost, and I am speaking on behalf of Catherine Rickard. She submitted this letter but wanted me to read it to you. Dear Chair Dembro and Senate Committee members, I am writing to plead that you pass Senate Bill 892 in your committee. Rural people like me need your help to feel safe on our property. Throughout 2014 and 2015, I came to the Capitol all the way from Gold Beach. That is a four-hour drive one way. I came with many of my neighbors who were also made ill from an aerial spray. We, the people, have lost faith in our government. We ask for our elected officials to protect us, rural residents, with advance notice of aerial spraying and buffer zone. As a result of our testimony telling the story of how nearly 40 people were made sick from pesticides that drifted onto our residential properties in Cedar Valley. The legislature adopted a 60-foot no-spray buffer from houses and schools that may help somewhat, but we still have no idea when a spray is going to occur or when chemicals may be drifting on the air currents near our homes. We hear that the lobbyists from timber and chemical companies want you and other legislatures to think that our experience was just a one-time incident, a mistake by a bad actor. The pilot was fined and his license was taken away by state agencies. But that is not the point. In our case, no one had an inkling that a spray was about to take place, not even the state foresters from the Department of Forestry. That pilot did not bother to file an updated notification. He did the spray job anyway, flying back and forth across our valley seven times without notifying state agencies or the residents whose homes he flew over. 40 people were exposed to 4D and triclopyr and crop oil, the chemical mixture he put in his spray tanks. Our story is proof that Senate Bill 892, requiring advance notification and information about the sprays, is desperately needed for rural residents. If advance notification had been required in 2013, when we were sprayed, the state foresters who were in charge of monitoring sprays would have been alerted. As it turned out, the absence of a spray notification and advance warning caused a significant delay in the state's investigation. ODF and ODA couldn't figure out who flew over our homes for weeks after the incident occurred. Sincerely, Catherine Rickard of Gold Beach.
Okay, thank you, Ms. C, and thank you, Catherine. Colleagues, questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much for coming, giving your testimony. Okay, let's have Mark Gourley, Ted Reese, and Dale Clausen, please.
Can make me look good.
Welcome.
Chair, Senator Dembro and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today and to testify. I am Mark Gourley, forester at Starker Forest, 38 years managing vegetation, forest vegetation in Benton, Lane, Lynn, Lincoln, and Polk counties. Currently, a lot of my coworkers have retired, but I'm probably overseeing more aerial applications in forestry than anybody else out there right now. Also, for the last 11 years, been chairman of the Oregon State University Vegetation Management Research Co-op, and that's what this publication's about, and I'll talk about it in a second here. Under the Oregon Forest Practices Rule, you can see this little picture here I'm handing out shows how we were able, through vegetation management and some nutrition research, 2 years and 10 months from seed, we had a tree hit 9 feet 7 inches. So in our organization, we way exceed the Forest Practices Rules. This Oregon Forest Practices Act requires 200 trees per acre in a free-to-grow status within 4 years of harvest. Free-to-grow status is 200 well-distributed trees, which will be vigorous and healthy and expected to eventually dominate vegetative competition. In this little annual report that our cooperative does, this is a State Forestry, Department of Natural Resources, Bureau of Land Management, and several private organizations in forestry participate in that cooperative. We fund it. And At age 16, on one of our study sites, on page 14, you'll see we had with Douglas fir, the reason why we spray, Douglas fir after 16 years had a 38% volume increase with our early vegetation management practices. Western hemlock on page 18 had between 61 and 184% volume increase. Western red cedar on page 20, almost a 500% volume increase. And grand fir on page 21, a 240% volume increase with the early application of herbicides. On page 62, under water stress and survival, we funded Dr. Panicki and Dr. Dinger, who studied and found and reinforced the importance of competing vegetation management on soil water availability, plant water stress, and stand growth for young seedlings. On most Oregon forest sites, survival and growth of young seedlings is poor without early weed control. Noxious and invasive weeds, literally dozens of new invasive weeds, insects, and fungi arrive in Oregon each year. Scotch broom laced with Himalaya blackberry occurring on steep slopes can only be treated by aerial spraying. Fog, wind, rain, and mechanical breakdowns make 24-hour notice impossible. Please oppose Senate Bill 892. And as a little side note, if I had to do the notification the way that the bill describes, right now I'm getting ready to aerial spray about 68 different units across three different counties here in the next couple weeks when the weather comes. I would just notify every unit every day that we haven't sprayed just to keep things rolling. We never know. I've gotten good over the years using my coat as a pillow, sleeping in my pickup. I've slept more hours in a pickup than any forester in Oregon, waiting for the weather to break on heliports. And two marches ago, during the whole month, we only sprayed 5 acres for the whole month of March. Last year, we had a day we got 700 acres. The weather was perfect. Everything worked. We never know what's going to happen out there. I could see us easily bogging up the computer system at State Forestry with us notifying every day our 50 or 60 units, that not knowing what we're going to do because of the weather. And I would think the cost of maintaining such a database, probably on the cloud, and the people, the programmers, and all the people that are going to have to do cybersecurity on these data clouds, probably, I just don't see how we can do it for less than $3 or $4 million, talking to the software people that I know. So again, I would please oppose Senate Bill 892.
Thanks, Mr. Gurley. Okay, welcome.
Thank you for the opportunity today. My name, for the record, is Ted Rice. I'm the current Timberlands Manager for Seneca Jones Timber Company based in Eugene, Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity. As I said, this is an important issue for our operation specifically, and I know you're going to hear more from other folks as well. I am concerned about the cost of implementation of Senate Bill 892. It would be costly to the Oregon Department of Forestry to implement a system required to receive an increased amount of information and continued changes to operation plans as weather impacts daily work. I hope you ask ODF about those plans and what they are actually able to do. I think they are certainly the experts on the FERN system, and it's come a long way. It would be costly to professional foresters and pesticide applicators and consultants, especially, and continued time and notification effort. I also believe these new requirements would cause many applications to be canceled. That, quite frankly, is the case because there aren't very many applicators that do this kind of sensitive work. Ultimately, and I think most importantly, it would not support better communication between neighboring landowners, an age-old challenge. I have a two-page outline in my hands right here that will go into the record. A two-page outline of the planning process needs prior to the operations phase of a program. Notification to the state is required by the OFPAs, but one notification process and planning requirement that takes hours and hours pardon me, to complete and, quite frankly, to get it right so that we know what sensitive resources are out there, so we know what we're talking about, we know what we're doing. We're doing the applications right based on EPA label instruction use rules. Hours of care information gathering and analysis are required to go through that process. Currently, notifications include all the information required for a proper review under the OFPA, including the exact application area. This triggers courtesy notification to neighbors who've requested information. That's how the FERN system works right now. As you heard, a new online version of the subscription system has been developed at great cost to ODF and will soon go into implementation. At Seneca, however, we don't depend on ODF to notify interested parties of our helicopter use plans. These are our neighbors. They're not neighbors for ODF. They're nobody else's neighbors. About a month prior to operations, we send courtesy letters to all neighbors who may be interested in talking with us about our plans. In fact, I have the letter dated March 19, 2014, to Miss Marie Paloma, a person that you heard about a little bit earlier. We do know Marie. We've talked with her several times. She's actually a great neighbor. This spring, we need to send letters to neighbors for just 12% of our individual application areas. A full 88% of the application areas are not adjacent to neighbors that may be interested in receiving notice, and specifically the target of this particular Senate bill. This is a costly proposal for relatively little benefit, at least with regard to the example of our spring program this year. ODF would be tracking a whole bunch of applications that, quite frankly, we're the only ones that care about them. I estimate approximately 30% of daylight hours during the application period are within weather guidelines for proper use by EPA regulations. Sometimes helicopter won't be able to apply for several days due to wind, rain, or temperature requirements. Some days the weather cooperates all day, leading to many applications being done from dawn to dusk. The initial plan, quite frankly, would not last past the first volley, as we hear in other contexts. So the application dates would change again and again and again, and quite frankly, I think that might cause more confusion and more anxious neighbors than we really want. Some applications would be left undone. There's no question about that, because mistakes would be made. We'd miss a window. Other people down the line who are depending on the helicopter moving from us to their property at some unknown date would unfortunately be left out. Most years, we don't even complete the manual application work plan due to availability of crew time as well. Contrary to popular belief, there are not enough people, enough manual application crews to do the work that we need to have done, as Mark so eloquently pointed out, the reasons why we do this work. There's simply, and most importantly, there is simply no better mechanism, not ODF notification system, not posting information on a website, not advertising in the local paper or the local TV. There's nothing more effective than personal contact through a letter, phone call, a personal visit between a professional forester and a neighbor. There's no app for good communication between neighbors. If your neighbor was planning to tear down and rebuild their home, what would you prefer? The notification that comes from the city planning department that you can talk to them to find out what's going to happen? There's no notification for, you know, rebuilding a house next to your property line 10 feet away on a Saturday morning in, you know, sometime in May. These things don't happen. Direct contact offers time to educate our neighbors about our needs, listen to and understand their needs, and then implement the activity with neighbor concerns taken into account. What you would really want from your neighbor that was going to rebuild their house is a handshake at the door to talk about what they're going to do. That's, quite frankly, what we do, and I think that's what happens the vast majority of the time when it comes to aerial application. This is the formula that's worked through my 20 years of experience. Please do not support Senate Bill 892 because it will cost too much and will not solve the age-old challenge of neighbors talking to neighbors. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senators. I'm Dale Clausen. I manage company-owned lands in the Coast Range west of Salem for Hampton Family Forest. As part of my land management duties, I maintain a private pesticide applicator's license and plan and supervise our spray projects. I am not a proponent of Senate Bill 892, as I do not believe it is a workable process.
I am responsible for the herbicide and fertilizer applications done on a portion of the company's forest lands and have been a part of such applications for almost 30 years. In that time, I don't think I've ever been able to, with 100% confidence, predict that I would be able to spray a certain unit on a certain day. We apply our chemical inputs sparingly over a 40 to 60 year growing cycle and strictly follow rules and regulations set for applications. As such, applications are always weather dependent. The weather determines when landowners can spray and how long it takes to finish a project. As local landowners often rely on the same operators, my schedule can fluctuate depending on when the operator is able to finish on another landowner's property and move to my project. When the helicopter is available, fog, rain, wind, and changing weather conditions dictate how much we can accomplish in a day if we can spray at all. We spend a lot of time setting on landings, watching the weather, and waiting for the set of conditions that meet our requirements for conducting a successful application. Even if a weather forecast is fairly accurate for Northwest Oregon or the Central Coast Range, it is not likely accurate enough for me to predict the specific conditions I need to put that helicopter in the air. As I understand this bill, I'm already doing what this legislation is trying to accomplish. I notify my neighbors of operations near their property. In addition, they're currently able to subscribe to the ODF notification system and receive notice of operations being planned in their subscription area. When we notify neighbors of our intent to spray, we discuss the operation with them, answer any questions, and if they want to be notified on the day we're spraying, I will call them the night before and let them know that we might be spraying the following day, again, weather permitting. Because of these reasons, I believe the added notification requirements in this bill are unworkable and unnecessary. Thank you.
Great, thank you. I have a couple of questions. So just for you, Dale. So when you have that relationship with the neighbor, you know, where you give them a phone call, what happens if the operation doesn't happen, if it's been, has to be postponed?
If they've asked for a call to know which day we're spraying, then I'll call them that evening and say, we weren't able to spray today, we're going to try again tomorrow. I'll have some idea of what the weather is and let them know that I'll continue to call until we get that project done.
So how is it any harder for you to call ODF and tell them that?
It wouldn't really be any harder, but I would prefer to talk to my neighbors specifically and have that relationship with them.
Yeah, I understand that. Ted, so, you know, you mentioned that a lot of the land, you know, that's being sprayed is very far from neighbors. I mean, it's internal, right, within a packet. And so you said just like 17% is kind of near neighbors and, you know, where that kind of notification would be required. So, you know, what if the notification part of this bill was just limited to those 17%? I mean, would that make it more workable?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. I appreciate the question, actually. I pointed out specifically that 12% of our individual application areas require some discussion with other neighbors. That's not to say that there aren't other landowner neighbors, and I don't want people to think that I'm trying to mislead, because quite frankly, BLM Forest Service, Dale's property, Starker, those are neighbors. However, we have good relationships. We are constantly talking with those folks, referencing primarily the people that you are targeting this particular Senate concept, Senate bill concept towards. I think quite frankly, we would be doing the same thing regardless of whether or not Amendment Dash 3 potentially would be introduced. We would be going through the same process. I am not comfortable resting on ODF's subscription service and notification system to make sure that our neighbors understand what we're doing. We talk to our neighbors about a variety of subjects. It's not all about aerial pesticide application, you can probably imagine. You know, you can look to the agriculture community for a really good example of excellent communication across property lines. where they actually grow crops in different timings to make sure that they watch for conflict issues and whatnot. I think we would be doing the same process. We're not comfortable with ODF taking the ball for us on this one. I would like to mention that Oregon Department of Forestry and Oregon Department of Agriculture, they are paid staff. They have regular hours. They don't work weekends most of the time. Pesticide applications, especially by helicopter, because it is so sensitive in terms of the requirements for weather. Quite frankly, a lot of the applications that that we're talking about are being done in off hours, and those phone calls are being made in off hours. So a phone call to ODF is not always the responsible way to go. I've been in a situation specifically where a small group of neighbors who are all in the same area wanted to talk to us specifically. We go and meet on the ground. They ask for a phone call. We do those phone calls. And went through the process, actually, of not being able to do the application for 2 or 3 days at a time. ODF just can't provide that kind of service. And again, it's a third party. I want to talk to those folks.
And Ted, let me say, it was never my intention in this legislation to have this preclude those kinds of ongoing conversations.
Oh, sure. Yes, understood.
That
yes,
this sir. Would just supplement, you know, your efforts to maintain those.
Yes,
any
sir.
Other questions? Yes, Vice Chair.
I have a question. Thank you. Ted, I guess this would be probably best handled by you, if you don't mind. I have concerns in the amendment when they talk about legal descriptions. Now, I'm used to legal descriptions in cities where I have lot boundaries and all of that stuff.
Yes, sir.
But you have large quantities of acres, I would assume, under one legal description. Is that correct, or am I mistaken there?
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, that's a good question, actually. It depends. When speaking specifically about county tax lot data, some county tax lots are very large, some are very small. Some timber companies, like the company that I work for, the owners that I work for, have many, many tax lots, and they are all together. So there really are no property lines per se, because it's us, and then it's us, and then it's us some more, and down the hill. So I think, quite frankly, it would depend on the definition of and the intent of the legal description, quote unquote, that Oregon Department of Forestry and the bill was looking for. I think that's a good question, and I'm not sure I can give you a proper answer as to what that definition would be.
Well, what I'm trying to get to is, I don't know how that you would define, if you had a 20-acre plot which had a single legal description and you only logged off 4 acres, how would you give a legal description for the area that you logged off and wanted to spray as compared to the entire 20 acres? That's what I'm just trying
gotcha.
To
okay.
clarify, because it says down in section 3G that when you report, you must report the legal description that was sprayed.
Yes.
And so I'm just concerned about, how do you define what that legal description is if that particular zone that you cut isn't defined by some geographic legal description?
Right. Thank you, Senator Dembro and members of the committee. Good question. Oregon's not flat.
Yeah.
Probably noticed that. Harvest units are not square, quite frankly, unless they're very small and you can work from edge to edge. But the fact remains, harvest units are really weird shapes, and anybody can see this going on Google Earth or whatever. But the legal description, as it's defined for the notification system within ODF, requires that you report down to, I think, the down to the 40-acre parcel where you are going to be doing an activity. I believe that's the lowest level that we're required to notify under the rules for ODF.
Right.
Although, a harvest unit could cross many of those, could touch just a tiny little piece. In that case, it's quite possible that the adjoining neighbor would be a quarter mile away from the harvest unit, legally, as far as the notification was concerned.
Thank you, Ted. And we'll be hearing from the department, really.
Okay.
This is existing rule, is my understanding. Senator Bertrager.
Just clarification. So right now you have to report down to the quarter corner.
is what you're saying.
Members of the committee, I believe that's the case. I could be wrong from a legal standpoint, but that's the process that as it exists now.
So you can say 20 acres in the southwest is out there.
Yes, sir. And then the process as well includes a map showing the exact boundary generally that's generated from, especially at a company level, a geographic information system to show exactly where it is. So assessment.
Technology is great now.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank
Let's
you.
Move on. And boy, there's too much interest in these in this bill. No, it's great. So, is there someone who's on the phone?
No, I need to call him.
Okay. Why don't we have Lisa Arkin?
He's got everyone under.
Yeah, I'm trying. David Eisler, and then there's someone on the phone. So, Lisa, David, if you could come forward. You know, they didn't check that.
They didn't check it.
Are we supposed to smile or wave or anything?
I look like doing something, but
looking good.
We're on Facebook anyway, huh?
Hello.
Hello. Is this John Burns?
Hello.
Hello. Is this John Burns?
Yes, this is John.
Hi, John. This is Senator Michael Dembro. We're here at a meeting of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. Discussing Senate Bill 892, which is the aerial spray notification bill.
Uh-huh.
And you're signed up to testify, so why don't we hear from you now, if you would.
Okay. All right, Senator, and thank you very much. And I'll go ahead and read something real quickly here.
He needs another thing.
Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity to express our feelings about these two Senate bills. My wife and I came to the
Mr. Burns, if you could just put your name on the record for us, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, John Burns, and my wife, Barbara Burns, is here.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. So I'll go ahead and continue.
Please do.
Okay. And so my wife and I came to the state capitol from Gold Beach at least six times during the 2015 legislative session. We asked for you, our elected officials, to protect us from the rural and our rural residents with advance notice of aerial spraying. You heard my factual account of what happened to us and 44 of our neighbors on that life-changing day on October 16, 2013. The ODA determined that the helicopter pilot dropped herbicides upon our residential properties. This event caused such irreversible harm to our health. Oregonians deserve to have the warning and to know what's being sprayed in our area. A number of my neighbors have small children who were outside at that time and were sprayed and got sick. As adults, we owe it to our children to protect them and keep them safe. We need the state to require that all pesticide applicators give timely warnings so that we can plan to bring everyone and our pets into a protected area. If the chemical records were required to be filed right away, our doctors would have been better able to treat our illnesses as quickly as possible. Perhaps we may not have ended up with the lasting health effects that we are now experiencing. Also, state agencies would be able to conduct investigations more effectively and efficiently. The rural people of Oregon are asking for help. We are at risk from pesticide drift and volatilization. We need reasonable and advanced warnings a few days before such sprays occur. We are not against logging. Most of the people in our community are connected to the timber industry. We simply want to keep our families safe and prevent this from happening to others in the community in the future. Many of us will be praying for you again in 2017 to pray that the right moral and just decisions to protect the Oregon people will happen. Please vote yes on SB 892 and SB 500. Passing these bills will give us hope for our future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burns. Thanks for taking this call and giving this public testimony. Lisa, you want to go next?
My name is Lisa Arkin. I'm the executive director of Beyond Toxics. We're a 4,000-member organization, and we work a lot in rural communities and serve rural residents of Oregon. And I was also a member of the 2015 various work groups that worked on the bill that were mentioned before. So I have quite a lot of experience in this issue. I just wanted to start by acknowledging the legislature, who has an online database system. I know I've personally quickly put in my email, and I can receive up-to-date notifications of committee agendas, changes in schedules, meetings, etc. The technology has improved so much, and our state has taken leadership to bring this kind of technology to the play so that participants and those who are in charge can communicate and essentially keep us informed. And we can do the same through the Ferns system. It's a very effective system. I wanted to start by just saying that in 2015, when we did a lot of hard work, the outcome might have been 60-foot buffers, but the outcome was certainly not strong pesticide laws in Oregon, as has been stated. When we compare what we have in our state with other states, Washington, California, Idaho, even Arizona, there are sometimes triple or more protections from pesticide drift for homes and schools. These are places where people live, work, and play, and they deserve that protection. Also, there's been complaints in 2016. We've had complaints again from Curry County. In the time period, there were over 36 complaints from Gold Beach, and yet somehow those numbers are lost when the industry groups are talking about how many complaints there are. There are problems out there, and those people are trying to communicate. And this is not just a matter of perception. These are true stories, and they're Oregonians. I remember a very poignant story of one of the many that I've heard. A grandmother in Josephine County was babysitting her two granddaughters, and the granddaughters heard the sound of the helicopter and ran outside to see the machine, and they were very excited. And they lived in a dell, and across the dell was the clear cut where the helicopters were working back and forth. And the vapors and the fumes from that spray drifted down with the air currents and enveloped those two little girls. The grandmother did eventually bring them inside, but the persistent symptoms caused her to take them to a doctor the next day, but she didn't know anything about chemicals or spray. She certainly didn't know how to file a complaint. And now one of those little girls has a chronic asthmatic condition, and the grandmother feels guilty, as if it were her fault that she had let them go outside. Drift from an aerial pesticide spray is common. It's a common occurrence, even when the applicator is taking precautions and following the law. And I would like to just read from you an Oregon State University publication that I did submit to the record talking about 240.
Lisa, could you make this quick? Because
yep.
Like maybe just the 2 minutes.
You got it. Thank you.
Yes.
Intended drift of herbicides can be caused by wind, shifting air currents, climatic inversions, or spraying at high pressure, which can cause a fine mist. Even small amounts carried by the wind can create symptoms, and in this case, in grapevines, but we're talking about human beings. So I want to end by saying that the Fern system can be capable of handling this information. It's not costly, but the benefits are significant. Ferns can easily serve as a centralized place to store spray records. Filling out an accurate spray record is already required by law. All the things in the bill are already required by law, but the current system lets pesticide sprayers keep their records without anyone else seeing it and file it privately wherever they choose. The lack of transparency and accountability has led to delay and problems with getting accurate records when the state forester demands those documents for an investigation or when a medical professional needs to know what pesticides have been sprayed to properly treat a patient. So please pass Senate Bill 892 as amended. Rural people have asked for this for so many years and have waited for this sensible policy. I hope we don't have to debate any longer the need to provide advanced notification and a record of the spray. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Mr. Eisler, welcome.
Thank you. I'm a retired anthropologist. My name is David Eisler, and I live in Walton, Oregon. I'm a retired anthropologist currently managing 160 acres of forest land in Walton. I've lived in Oregon Coast Range since the late 1970s. In 1982, I was breaking ground for my family's first garden when the herbicide Garlon drifted from a clear-cut unit being sprayed about three-quarters of a mile away. I called ODF, and I was told in no uncertain terms that I could not possibly be smelling the herbicide because the spray technology assures that the chemicals drop directly below the helicopter. End of discussion. So I began looking at the research on forestry chemicals. In the 1970s, the U.S. Forest Service published a number of reports on chemical drift from helicopter applications and described the complexity of factors affecting chemical transport. Over the decades, state and local agencies across the country discussed methodologies of delivery to improve aerial applications in order to reduce drift through appropriate nozzle designs, flight patterns, and additives that control droplet size. If you visit websites for nozzle spray manufacturing companies, most will begin by stating that drift happens, and it is important to employ the best technology and practices to reduce drift. They do not say eliminate drift. They rather say reduce drift. Steep Coast Range mountains provide a particular risk to safe helicopter applications. Quickly changing micro weather conditions, sudden updrafts and downdrafts, fog, shifts in wind velocity and direction can result in factors favorable for the movement of chemicals off target. Simply put, drift happens, and it is recognized by the industry. In 2012, we placed an air sampling monitor in the backyard of a family residence about a half mile from a steep slope clear cut being sprayed. We recorded the presence of the principal ingredient, imazapyr. Drift happened. It's simply a fact of atmospheric and chemical physics. Given sets of certain conditions, airborne chemicals may find their way to individual homes or communities. For families living in the forested portions of this state, there has always been the potential for forestry chemical trespass on their property, into their drinking water, or into their lungs. It should not be considered a risk that a landowner has to accept for living near forested areas. Giving landowners access to the information of what will be sprayed and when seems only right. I urge you to support Senate Bill 892 for rural communities and rural families across the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. Thank you both very much. Can I have Dave Cramsey, Dustin Clark, and Dave Rankin, please? Gentlemen, welcome. Whoever would like to start, just all I ask is that you give us your name.
So I'm older than he is, so I'll start.
Great.
Okay. Senator Dembrough and members of the committee. I'm Dave Rankin. I bring you greetings from Western Lane County. My wife and I own 184 acres of forest land in Western Lane County, approximately 2 miles southeast of the city of Florence, along the south inlet of the Siuslaw River. We've owned and managed this property since 1973, Our efforts early on were to let things grow. In 2014, we completed a 20-acre harvest. This operation contributed 143 loads of forest products to five separate mills and also to export from the port of Coos Bay. The area harvested has now been replanted with 6,000 Douglas fir seedlings and 1,000 Western red cedar. Prior to replanting, the area was treated via backpack sprayers to control emergent vegetation, which would compete with seedlings and restrict their ability to become free to grow. We have another harvest of 34 acres in the planning stages. This operation will occur on a coastal landform, necessitating a yarder-based clear-cut harvest. The area involved is adjacent to the previous unit. The proposed harvest unit is suitable for an aerial application of products aimed at site preparation and release of seedlings from competitive species and brush. It's impossible to grow a new forest on the Coast Range without using herbicides to control brush. Now, I have heard, and I'll deviate here, that there are roving bands of hippies that will come and clear brush on your property for $30 an acre. I have yet to find those crews out there. I'm looking for them, but if they're there, I'd like them to contact me.
You might have to provide them with something other than money.
Western Lane County might have that product. Close by. Planning for an aerial application necessitates specific selection of target dates. It's all dependent on aircraft availability and weather. The many additional timing requirements to use aerial application as proposed in Senate Bill 892 would preclude an orderly operation to occur should weather conditions eliminate a date selected for application and the availability of equipment to spray the herbicides, because everybody else who is trying to apply herbicides is having the same problem. We therefore oppose Senate Bill 892. My next comments here are more in line with Senate Bill 500. Is that permissible to go ahead on that or not?
Go ahead and do it.
Okay, not very long. We considered aerial application of herbicides on our 20-acre harvest. Size and proximity to South Inlet, three streams, a small lake, a 120-foot-wide riparian management zone where no trees were harvested, and constricted flight clearance led us to choose a manual application of herbicide. The replant went well, and the seedlings are coming along nicely. As we speak, a notice of operation has been filed with Oregon Department of Forestry for an application of herbicide in the same area to control scotch broom. Control of this insidious forest invasive species will be manually applied basin spray. We oppose Senate Bill 500. Our conflict is the open-ended period of time proposed for a notice of damage to occur long after there is adequate time to do a fair investigation. The 60-day requirement in current law is more than adequate. We strive to responsibly follow the Forest Practices Act and specific rules aimed toward various forest operations. We believe all owners of forest land abide by these rules and oppose open-ended time frames to claim loss and further regulation of herbicide application. I urge the committee to recommend a no-pass designation for these two bills. Tree farmers and foresters need the available tools in the toolbox to keep forests growing in a timely, beneficial manner. Responsible management of invasive species and competing vegetation via herbicide application is one of the tools. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rankin. Okay, next.
Dustin Clark. I don't know if I'm supposed to feel good about my speech being shorter than his or not, but...
It makes us feel good.
Okay, good, good. Yes. My name is Dustin Clark, and I'm the president of Coos County Sheep Company, a third-generation tree farm just outside of Coos Bay, Oregon, which was started in 1935 by my grandfather. Now, I know that the name Coos County Sheep Company doesn't really tie you into forestry, but to make 80 years of history very short, the bears ate the sheep, and you can't prevent the trees from growing. So Coos County Sheep Company very quickly morphed into a timber company. And these days, we exclusively grow trees. But, you know, it's a family operation. My mother and my grandfather, well, my mother grew up on that ranch, ran sheep down through what used to be beautiful grass fields. And, you know, they used to light it all on fire in order to keep the trees down. But these days, we just grow trees. And one of the best tools in our tool belt is the aerial application of herbicide. It's a race between the grass and the brush and the seedling that you plant to get above the tallest brush that will grow. And the most effective tool that we have in our tool belt is aerial application of herbicide. And in that same kind of vein, we're members of Oregon Small Woodlands, and we are small as far as timber landowners. And so we tend to, for these applications, piggyback on our neighbors, which are some of the larger timber managers. And so it's an important point that we piggyback with these professionals. And coming from I started out as a high school health teacher, starting out from there and then changing occupation, it was great to be so welcomed by the forestry community. And our local big timber managers really do a good job at helping us do things like this aerial application of spray. But 892 will put us as small woodland owners kind of at the end of the line. The trickle down will end up and hurt small woodland owners the most because of Mother Nature being so fickle. The people that will lose the most will be the small woodland owners who partner with these bigger companies. But then in the end, when push comes to shove and the season is not amicable, we'll be the ones that will be left out in the cold with more legislation in the way. And that financial impact will be significant. Spray does really make the trees grow, kind of like Starker Forrester said previously, so I'll skip some of that. But so it will have a real financial impact on our small timber company. So thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you very much. Mr. Cramsey.
Good afternoon, Chair Denver and committee. My name is Dave Cramsey. I'm an area forester for Roseburg Forest Products, and I work in primarily Lane County, Northern Douglas County, Benton County. I've been fortunate to be in that position for 20 years on the same land base. I've been involved with the application of herbicides for over 30 years now in my career. One of the things that I hope everybody understands is that foresters care. Okay, we care about the environment, we care about our neighbors, we care about our employees. If products were unhealthy, we would not use them. We believe in the science, we believe in the technology for application, for deposition, and those conditions need to the conditions for that to occur properly is weather dependent, and the weather controls what we do. As you've already heard today, one bad day of weather can set you behind 2 days in your work if the next day doesn't allow you to maintain your average. The process that's outlined in this Senate bill is one that if the helicopter arrives late, 4 days late onto a project, I will have to reset dates for every unit. If I have an east wind event that grounds us for 2 days, I will have to reset every unit that's not completed after that. My concern is that will cause multiple notifications to our neighbors, cause confusion and a high level of frustration with them. They really won't know when we're coming with that. I prefer the model that you've heard of, and that's one of communicating directly with your neighbors. That's one that we do at our company, and many companies do. It's not just a few companies. We know our neighbors. We will work with them, let them know what we're doing, when we're doing it, and if they would like to know the day before, we're happy to give them a call. Sometimes we call them 3-4 days in a row because the weather does not cooperate. The record-keeping requirements in this bill are repetitive with what exists currently. Applicators and landowners are required to maintain the same elements for their records. In forestry, we're required to make those available to the state forester upon request. So the state forester can call me up a week later and say, I need your records for this application, and I have to provide them. So the information is attainable. I would encourage you to think about the problems that we're trying to solve with this bill and look hard to see if we're really solving those problems or if we're perhaps creating some other problems. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Senator Robles.
I could not let it go by without acknowledging one of my students, Dusty Clark, and the fact that his mother was one of our soccer coaches, that his dad was our pediatricians, that his family has been around for a long time, and most of you would recognize if he said anything about his grandfather, who in more than a few occasions, as Dusty and others were riding around, he'd say, that's his truck right over there, and I'd say, how do you know it's his truck? Because all of the dents, I know where those dents came from as he worked around the park. And if you, and I'll let Dusty say that because I had this question, if you heard his grandfather's name, you would understand another Oregon icon with respect to outdoors and other kinds of things. So, Dusty, who's your grandfather?
Howard Leatherman.
And so a relative of theirs, an uncle, I think.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Invented a little tool that many of us use. So yep. It was important for me to say thanks for being here, Dusty, and it's been a lost education that you aren't teaching.
Thank you.
And his other grandfather was a principal of Coquille High School.
Well,
it's all true. Well, some take the right path.
And I know. What can I say? It was nice of him to follow in his grandfather's step. But
okay, thank
really
you
great.
Very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dusty. Yeah.
So let me say what we're going to do. You guys can go. I'm going to call the department up now because I want to make sure everyone gets to hear them or gets to ask them questions.
Great people.
And then hear from people remaining. We're going to lose senators. I'm happy to stay for a while. What I would like to do is open up Senate Bill 500. We're going to have to reschedule Senate Bill 500, but I want to open it up to take testimony from anybody who has traveled more than 100 miles to come, and we'll try to set up a date for another hearing on this a couple of weeks out just to give people time to prepare for it. So that's seems to make the most sense to me. Sorry, we obviously should have just scheduled this bill for today, but I've really appreciated the testimony. So, Peter, do you want to kick it off?
Yeah, good afternoon, Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. I'm Peter Doherty, and I serve as a Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Department of Forestry. With me here today is Lena Tucker, our Private Forest Division Chief. We've submitted written testimony, and in deference to time, we'll be just glad to answer any questions you may have. One I know that's come up is the question of the legal description, and what we did was match up what's currently required on application records. So under the Forest Practice Administrative Rules, that list of things, including legal description, is required on the application records that all chemical applicators keep at the site when they do it. So that is township range section. It's you know, maybe we should update it at some point because our notification used to be a box that had quarter sections on and you filled them out, and that's where it is. So all they do is write the quarter section that they're in for that record. So it's not any new information. It's information that's currently being recorded at applications.
Okay,
so other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
So help me understand exactly what's going to be new in the sense of in the Ferns system. There's already requirements, from what I understand, as to what's going to be or what is currently required to be posted or given to the Forest Department. I understand that there's now going to be date certain with a couple of float dates, and I guess maybe a more specific time frame for when they have to declare that the job's been done, what was actually applied, and the location. So help me out as to what are the new things that's going to be added that that's not current law at this point.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lena Tucker, Private Forest Division Chief with ODF. Senator Prozanski, to answer your question, the three key components that would be new functionality into the e-notification system, affectionately called FERNS, because when foresters name things, they stick, and public affairs tells us we never get to name things again. Anyway, the three components that would be a change in functionality would be the lifespan of the overall notification of operations. So currently they can notify, landowner, timber owner, operator can notify on January 1st. The lifespan of their notification is good for 1 year. So this bill makes a requirement for a notification of operation for chemical pesticide or pesticide application, aerial pesticide application, reduces the lifespan to basically a 3 month window. So the lifespan of the notification is good. So that would be a change in functionality.
So can you walk us through the 3 months? Because what I've heard from the testimony, it's a 5 days with the day that you're going to apply and then 2 days on either side. So this is like a pre-notice prior to that. Then you go to the subset of the 5 days?
It's kind of a two-step process. So by law, a timber owner, landowner, forest owner, operator must notify the state forester that they're going to conduct an operation on forest land. And so that's the overall notification, what they're going to do, where they're going to do it. And that's for administrative purposes, to help our stewardship foresters know what is happening out on forest land so they can effectively administer the Forest Practices Act. Back to the legal description, we need to find out where they're operating so that we can make a visit and ensure that the Forest Practices Act is being carried out. So with the 3 month window, instead of a year long notification, it gets reduced to 3 months. The second piece of the new functionality would be pinpointing the actual application date for the aerial spray operation. And so within that, they have to identify, we think we're going to spray on March 15th, and then there is a two-day window, grace period, leeway on either side of it. So that would be a new functionality. The third component, which is a new addition, is the uploading or posting of what we call a daily spray record, which is the details of weather conditions, what was sprayed, when, and where after the operation has been completed.
And if I can follow up on that. And from what I've heard from the testimony, again, that has to be done within 48 hours or a short time after it's been actually applied?
The daily spray record uploading?
Yes.
That's a five-day window.
Five-day window.
After they finish the application, they have 5 days to upload the daily spray record after the operation is finished.
What is the current requirement for a current law, not the new?
For the daily spray record, they have to fill it out. They have to retain it. They do not have to submit it to the Department of Forestry unless
they just hold on to it unless you come in and say we
yes.
need to see it.
Mm-hmm.
If you make that request, how quickly do they have to have it to provide it to you?
As soon as possible. And operators are very responsive when we do make those requests.
And one other question. Just how quickly, from what you remember, the quickest that you've asked for those records after or the as it comes in, like say a neighbor or someone says, I'd like to know what's going on, what was sprayed. Can you tell us how quickly you've ever made a request for that information from the applicator?
I wouldn't have.
Just estimate.
It's quick. I mean, if we have a request to provide the spray record in the event of an investigation or an enforcement action through ODA and OHA, then we get the information fairly quickly. People are quick to comply and provide that information.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up. Mm-hmm. I understand from what you just said, if that was an agency request because they're doing an investigation or something, what if a neighbor who lives close by called the Forest Department and said, our neighbors just finished playing, we'd like to know what they did.
Mm-hmm.
How quickly would they have a response, or do they have the right to get that information?
Senator Prozanski, we have a pesticide analytical response center established in the state of Oregon, which is a multi-agency response to pesticide concerns.
Park.
Yeah, PARC.
So they have to go through PARC still?
They would, or call the 211 number. And then the request usually comes from PARC for us to ask for the record after it's been evaluated. So that can happen relatively quickly, and then we would contact immediately the operator. And, you know, it can be as fast as, you know, a day from when we're, because they can fax it to us. You know, it just depends on how fast the decision is made to begin an investigation.
I'll follow up on that. So I understand we've had this situation, many of us in this room, regarding a situation in the Triangle Lake area.
Yep.
And I understand PARC. So at this point, what I'm hearing is that if an individual just calls and wants this information, they don't have access to it through public records. They have to actually go through PARC. PARC's going to have to do some type of investigation to determine whether or not that request should be honored. Then they're going to come to the Forest Department, and then you're going to go and ask the applicator. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And so under this bill, they could just go online and get that information directly. Right. In terms of the department's capacity to handle what we're asking it to handle under this bill, Peter, somebody speculated that it would cost $3 to $4 million for you to receive the information and the changes, et cetera. Can you say something about the department's capacity to handle what's being envisioned here?
I'm going to defer to Lena. She's done. She's been our lead on our e-notification system, which I unaffectionately know as Fern. and so I'll turn it over to her. We have some rough estimates. We have it. There's been amendments, but we do have some rough estimates on what it would cost to update the e-notification system to have this capacity.
Yes, thank you. Senator Dembrough, members of the committee. First of all, let me back up a little bit and talk about the subscriber functionality in e-notification that is being developed as we speak. We will have a test version available in April, and which means we will actually test the functionality for the public portal, which is an online registration for subscribers. They get their own accounts, get their own dashboard. They get to choose the activities that they're interested in receiving notifications on. They get to designate their area of interest, whether it's around their home, a full county, a watershed. They have a couple different ways that they can indicate that. They will get immediate email alerts when a notification of operation comes in that is within their area of interest. And they'll be able to view the notification summary page, the details on what the operation is about. And they'll be able to provide comments on a statutory written plan within 14 days of receiving that notification. And of course, with the launch of this functionality, this is free of charge. There is no charge for the online access. We are targeting mid-June 2017 for the live go live launch date. Testing phase will take place here in April and May to make sure the functionality is working. We do have interested citizens that have attended some of our outreach sessions that have signed up, said they'd like to test the functionality, help us make sure it's working. So when that comes online, we'll have the components in place to basically provide the triggers or the alerts to the interested citizens for these other functions that would occur in this bill. So for example, if somebody chooses the proposed date for the spray notification, there'd be a trigger that goes to the subscriber if that falls in their area of interest, where they'd be able to say, okay, here's the proposed date. If that changes, they'll get another trigger all through email. So, you know, almost instantaneous. The functionality that we have to
make changes to is on the notifier side, the timber owner, landowner, operator who has to submit the original notification. So we have to make the component changes to allow for a shortened lifespan of a aerial application. And the tricky one is that window of time, 2 days prior, 2 days after proposed date. That's probably going to take the most amount of development time and resources. And then uploading of a daily spray record is fairly easy. I have not vetted this with our contractor. We've done a base estimate of time and resources. And it's about $250,000 to accomplish these adjustments or changes within the e-notification system. But the good thing is once the subscriber portal is online, that piece is set, and we just have to have the triggers on the new requirements.
And the concern about being swamped by telephone calls, you know, for changes. You know, when we talked about this 5-day window, it seemed like that would be something that would be manageable. You know, we're hearing today of hundreds or thousands of changes being potentially requested. Just in your experience, is that real, or is that potentially exaggerated for the sake of argument, if I can put it that way?
So Senator Dembro, I haven't been a dirt forester for probably since I can remember. We did check with our State Forest Division, and who are a landowner and an operator, and they did raise some concerns about the difficulty, particularly on our smaller districts, which would be analogous to a family forest landowner, because of actually knowing the date. They don't know the date that they're, maybe till the day before. So it will add some cost. I don't have a good estimate of how that would do, but for instance, our West Oregon district has a multi-year contract with an operator, and so they will send in their units, and that contractor will just fit them in to his other work, and they'll get a call saying, hey, we think we're going to be up in your area next week, and we're planning to do this day. So some degree of cost. I know at one time there was a talk about calling into ODF. I would hope that this would be that we're not having our administrative folks trying to field phone calls and call up, and then it would be something that would be the landowner operator responsibility to update the system.
Yeah, if we can make it as simple as mashing a button to say, I want to, fast forward my proposed date, similar to what we do today when they want to continue a notification from 1 year to the next, it's a button that says, I want to continue. So that's what we're envisioning, to make it easy for landowner, timber owner, operator to adjust their proposed date, easy for us to receive the information on our side.
So, Peter, just, you know, based on your experience, does, you know, that which is being proposed in this bill, does it seem reasonable for a landowner? I realize the department is not taking a formal position one way or another, but, you know, we're trying to craft this in a way that will, you know, the goal is to minimize the impact on the landowners and operators while providing as much, you know, real-time notice as possible for people who want this.
I will be careful in saying this. I think we've designed it so that technically it's as easy as it can be technically in terms of operations and the impact on operations. I don't have the experience to know how difficult that's going to be. And I think we'll, I would defer to the landowner community in terms of some of their concerns, in terms of that.
Senator Brooklyn.
So is it designed so that I could say that I want it on the 7th of March, or whatever day? We'll go with March because we're here in March. 7th of March, and then also apply at the same time for the 10th of March, and then the 12th of March, and then the 14th of March, and then the 27th of March, and for the same plot. For out for 2 months, and then do it for my next one and do the same thing, so that if I have it coming, I will have definitely met the notification requirement?
I think there's nothing in our system that you couldn't file multiple notifications for the same unit. What the design that Lena was referring to, the push button design, is that if you put it in on March 7th and you miss that 4-day or 5-day window, then you would just hit a button, and that button would then know to roll that date forward automatically. So instead of filing a whole new notification, you would just go from the 7th to the 10th.
But the issue is that I was hearing today, I have 4 or 5 different places that I'm going to go, and I don't know what the weather's going to be like for any one of them. So if I file all of them for a period of a month and a half, then I can go to the one I need to go to on the day on which it happens, right? Where if I have to push the button, then I've always got to be worrying, uh-oh, can I do that button? Which button do I push at each time? I mean, I'm just saying, if I'm a person trying to plan for an activity, how many times do I have to push the button? And wouldn't it be easier just to file them all at the first time and have them all in there, so that it really hasn't done much more than what we do right now, which says we're going to be there certain times, other than the fact that they know they didn't do it in that last 5 days, and they might be doing it the next 5 days.
We certainly wouldn't want them to do that, because that would be totally unuseful. For the neighbors.
No, I agree with that. I'm just saying that the useful part would be that the person called them up the night before, because they were a neighbor and they had done that. I mean, we were already talking about that. I'm just saying, if I'm trying to manage a big operation and I have a lot of deals. Now, for some, that's not as hard as others, because they've only got one little spot of air. The small guy has one plot. Every 5 days they can push the button for their one plot, because that's the only thing they care about. For people that have multiple ones, if we develop the system, they will figure out how to make it work for themselves, and I don't want to get in the way of making it work. So I'm trying to figure out how to do that in a way that makes sense.
And again, we're trying to design this so it's the simplest. So ideally it is just pushing a button to roll it forward, because presumably the operator, the landowner, wants to do this operation. And there is a role, isn't there, for the local forester, the state forester? I mean, does the local forester is notified, isn't he or she, about an operation that's happening?
We have the notification system, and then given our workforce, we prioritize which notifications we do pre-op inspections on. Generally, with pesticide applications, we don't see a lot of resource violations or concerns, and so usually we're only present on those sites when we know there's a local concern and the company's asked us to be there to inspect, because the evidence of off-site drift is much more evident, a week later rather than being on site. There isn't a lot of reason to be on site unless we want to be there because there's a concern that we're documenting the weather, because there's citizen concerns around it. So not so much in terms of that, unless there's a specific request from a company for us to be on site.
Okay, so the local forester isn't going to be notified currently that an operation is in the works normally?
It depends on the operation and the resources at risk in terms of whether we'll be there and whether we're inspecting.
I mean that you'll be notified that an operation is going to happen. That happens rarely?
It happens more often around fire protection and to know which operations are active, so that our fire protection program will know where equipment is potentially, or if there is a fire start, if it could be an operator fire, where current active operations are. But those tend to be along harvest operations where we get notifications on when they're active.
Senator Robles.
So I've always been interested, and this is a question I probably shouldn't ask because I don't know the answer right now, so it's always best to ask questions I don't have answers to. Do these pesticides that are applied, do they individually have odor, or are they like natural gas? They have no odor, so we put stuff in them to have odor so we can warn ourselves. Do they have odor?
Most of the, I believe a lot of them have odor. Now you're, I'm not a chemical expert.
Right.
I believe some of the carriers have odors as well. But
yeah, and the carriers.
That which binds them.
The binding stuff. Some of it's more volatile too, right? So it can evaporate. I don't know the answer to that question. That's what I'm trying to figure out. If it doesn't, so then the molecules are at a size that come out of the nozzle, so they tend to drop straight down as opposed to doing it. If I can smell something and I'm a ways away, am I smelling chemicals? It's frustrating to me because I have been places where nothing ever died, so there obviously wasn't any overspray with respect to the pesticides because nothing did. But people said that they smelled something at the time it was being in it, and that makes me wonder, what are they smelling?
With all due respect, you're way outside my
okay, that's
expertise.
Fair enough.
And I don't know the answer to that question as well. That would really be someone that has a background in chemistry.
I'll figure that out. I'll go find that out myself.
Yeah. Senator Pruszynski, and then we'll let you go.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on the questions asked earlier, and this is on notification for current notification. Under the example y'all gave, someone could give a notification on January 1 of this year. It goes until the end of this year, which would be December 31st. When, or is there another time after that notification has been given to the department that they actually have followed through with their application? Do you get something 30 days before, or 3 months before, or how do you know, or do you take a crew out there? Or I'm just trying to find out. Whatever notifications do you get after the first one that could be in existence for a year?
There's no requirement for further notification. Generally, we're often contacted, particularly when there's protected resources, because an operator or landowner will want us to come out and make sure what they think they're doing is going to be compliant with the Forest Practice Act. On a lot of simple operations, we don't. A lot of times with family forest landowners, they'll notify just in case they're going to do something, and so they may not even operate through that year, but they've put in their notice, so if the market picks up, then they can operate quickly. So the idea of the system is to be efficient and effective, and so once you've notified, you can respond pretty quickly if you decide the market's really picked up and I want to harvest, and you could be out there. But no further legal requirement to notify us beyond.
Thank you.
So again, the forester is only going to come out if the landowner thinks that he or she would like to have an ODF person there.
And generally, on aerial applications, we prioritize for resource protection. So if it has a stream or a high landslide hazard, or other protected resources such as specified spotted owls or something like that, we prioritize our reports for pre-op and active operation post operation inspections to be the highest priority because we don't have the numbers to inspect every single operation.
But how could you inspect any operations if you don't know they're going to happen other than within a year?
And so landowners communicate regularly with our stewardship foresters, and so it's very much an education engineering. So they're usually wanting to know when an operation that they're starting up, they wanted us to check something. So that's generally how, and then as I mentioned, for once we get into fire season, then everybody wants to know where the operations are, and they generally send an email saying, hey, we're starting this operation up, we finished this one. And so there's a fair amount of informal communication at the district level about what's going on, so everybody's on the same page.
So can I just say, please. You said resource foresters, and it's really nice, therefore, if we fund our statewide at the appropriate level so that we have resource foresters?
Stewardship foresters, yeah.
Stewardship foresters. Mm-hmm. They are helpful in this whole process.
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure everybody knows that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That other $9 million is a nice added ingredient that helps us do the right things and know what's going on. Okay.
Okay. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your help with getting this bill technically correct.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, we have a couple more panels to go on this bill. I'd like to finish it out. Sorry, we're keeping people late, but I'll be here. Dear Beth will be here, and Shelley, and so we can get some testimony on the record. Can I have Thomas Mosher and Chris Hatton and Marvin Sandis? If you're all here, that would be great. Thomas, why don't you get started?
Sure, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Thomas Mosher. I'm here on behalf of the Portland Audubon Society. We support SB 892. We feel the bill provides critical information to the public. Knowing when there will be an aerial spraying and what's being sprayed are just basic information that should be provided to people. We'd love a deeper conversation around regulating these procedures, but we believe this is a needed start, and we support the bill. We hope you put it through. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Okay, so I guess we don't have Marvin or Chris. I have no questions of you, Thomas.
Thanks.
Thank you. Can I have Nancy Hathaway? Is she still here? Thank you for your patience, Nancy. Greg Peterson? Is he here? Okay, I think those are our last two people. Is there anyone else who had signed up for 892? Okay, great then. Nancy?
Yes, welcome. Obviously I'm Nancy Hathaway. I live in Corvallis, and I'm an active tree farmer owning and managing almost 1,000 acres. I own three properties in West Lane County and others in Douglas, Coos, Polk, but mostly in Benton County where I live. So my entire schedule revolves around supervising planting, backpack spraying, herbicide, living with my chainsaw, cutting brush, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm here today because it's wet outside. I can't apply deer protection to my young seedlings, but above all, because I feel strongly about these issues. So I prepared my testimony to talk to both 892 and 500. I don't know how you feel about that now.
Why don't you go ahead and do
okay.
that?
You would. Well, I think it's been pretty well explained about 892. I do, and I have done about 40 years of backpack spraying back when atrazine wasn't a restricted chemical, and I never wore a mask or anything, so it's interesting how times have changed. I used a consultant who bunched a group of us small woodland owners together, and as has been mentioned, it's a cascading effect, and being small, you're always at the end of the list. The big guys get done first, and if they have time and it doesn't start raining or something, then you're on. But if not, you're not. So if it starts to rain or whatever, wind problems, there could be up to 7 tree farmers scrambling to reschedule. I feel that the problem with this bill is the 5-day window. And also, Peter's gone. Ferns doesn't always work for me. It's hard to get on and put things on. And so last week I had to drive out to ODF and have the forester help me do that. And I also wonder about being an online system, people who live in the country, if they're actually going to be able to access that. About the aerial spraying, it's tough enough in Oregon to decide what to wear when heading out for a day-long event. Raincoat, umbrella, rubber boots, rain hat, sunscreen. It's really kind of incredulous that now we should be expected to rely totally on a weathercaster. I'm glad that the amendment is down to 15 days. The 30-day reporting or designating a date 30 days out is really crazy. Just more complications for us. Weather here in Oregon is in this month, March, is just too unpredictable. And, you know, as you've seen, we have had 2 or 3 days of dry. About Senate Bill 500, I consider that a thinly veiled attempt to end timber harvesting. We tree farmers keep getting whacked by these attempts one after another. I particularly take offense at Senate Bill 500, which I consider a sneak attack land grab, because after a certain amount of years, after an herbicide spray, a neighbor who wants to claim a loss comes forward with a lawsuit against you. It would be almost impossible to examine for evidence after so long a time, and additionally, the expenses in hiring investigators and attorneys may result in your having to sell your tree farm to pay those bills. So I just want, in closing, I want to say I'm not a professional forester. I'm an ordinary person willing to work hard for a distant reward and because I like being outdoors. However, I regret more that more and more of our time is spent coming to Salem to deal with these preposterous ideas. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm Greg Peterson. I also live in Corvallis, very close to Nancy. I'm a registered professional civil engineer with over 45 years experience dealing with over 1,000 hazardous waste sites, doing the environmental remediation of those sites, as well as hundreds of chemical handling systems and water resources projects. I'm here today because I'm an active tree farmer. I own 60 acres in West Lane County and feel very strongly about both Senate Bill 892 and 500 because I think those are both overreaching attempts to interfere and impair with the family forest operations that occur today and place a special burden on the small landowner who can't develop the systems to keep up with all the expectations of how easy it's, in theory, going to be. In my 45 years as a professional engineer, I've witnessed some very, very significant changes in the ways that herbicides are tested, how they're labeled, how they're handled, and how they're applied. And most interesting is that when I started, a lot of the detection levels were in the parts per million. Then they went to parts per billion. Now they're down at the parts per trillion levels. And what that means is when people say that they have detectable levels, it doesn't mean that they're any worse off. It just means the detection level keeps dropping and dropping and dropping down. So it, in a lot of cases, you have hits which are well below the actual detection levels. I am also a licensed herbicide applicator in Oregon, and I believe, and I've studied all the laws for herbicide application very thoroughly, gone to several courses on that. And I believe that when following the existing laws for herbicide application, which are really based on the experience of thousands of experts and literally hundreds of thousands of hours, that they really do provide adequate safeguards to landowners, to the applicators, and to the environment. Today's forest practices are already providing clean water and bountiful wildlife habitat, but the feasibility of continuing our forest ownership is really being challenged by those two bills. And I'd like to make comment about the comment that we could do without herbicides. And I will personally tell you I spend almost every day of the year fighting noxious weeds, which scotch broom, blackberries, honeysuckle, false broom, the list goes on and on and on. A lot of these are invasive species. And there is no way that you would be able to do forestry today without the use of herbicides. It's just literally impossible. I do a lot of backpack spraying. I always do a 60-foot border around the neighbors and always keep close contact with the neighbors, but sometimes it just basically is just not feasible to backpack the whole hillside. So I have used helicopters in the past, but I think it's really difficult to imagine how the proposed bill is going to work as far as notification windows, and particularly since small landowners, as been mentioned before, really just piggyback together, and I'm always at the very, very last of the list because I usually piggyback on to Weyerhaeuser or Seneca Jones, and I've been left out in the cold a couple times, and so then I have to scramble to try to find land applicators who can actually land spray it, and it's tough to find those crews because they're very, very busy, and I think as Mark Gorley testified, they actually have a lot more work to do than they can possibly do. So if you call them up and say, oh, I can't get the helicopter spray, I need, you know, 8 guys for 3 days, they're not going to do it. So you're stuck. I mean, you basically lose the spraying opportunity for the year. I hope that you will take our comments into consideration and that the farmers, ranchers, and tree farmers will not be punished.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. So what would be a reasonable window then, given your experience, for when an application could be scheduled?
Well, you try to schedule it, you look at the weather, but a lot of times the weather changes dramatically. I mean, the weather forecast isn't accurate 30 days out, and so, and you've got a lot of other things going on.
Or the wind.
And the wind
always comes up. But I mean, in terms of how, in your experience, your operations have been postponed.
Right.
You know, are we talking about, you know, 2 weeks, a month? I mean, from when you had hoped to have the operation and from and when the operation actually occurs.
Well, what happens is, first off, you have to get on the list of the helicopter spray operation. There's literally a list of 100 people there. And so you try to group it up, and they only work in a certain area. And so you get grouped in with people in your basic vicinity because they can't fly that far economically. But if for some reason the wind or the rain is off, and if you have to reschedule because there's other people behind you on the list, and all of a sudden you get outside the applicable window, because when it gets to mid-April, the trees are starting to grow and to bud out, and a lot of times you can't spray past about mid-April or first of May usually, and you're just basically done.
Oh, he wants to know how many days, I think.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, you know, when you have, you know, you had hoped for, you know, March 15th, but, you know, it's had to be postponed. I mean, how long have you had to wait?
Oh, well, I had one that, yeah, that was about mid-March, and then it was postponed twice. Finally, I barely got it done about April 1st, luckily. But, I mean, it was just, I mean, he was trying to cover all the people who had been postponed in the future. So I did happen to get lucky and get that done, that particular one. But I did have to, like I say, wait 2 weeks. And, of course, I had to put off other things I was supposed to get done. If for some reason the weather hadn't been good that particular day, it wouldn't have been able to get done that year. And I did basically be out. So, and I have very steep ground and very difficult to get to.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, what I'm getting at is, you know, we're hearing people say that a five-day window is too short of a period.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah,
so I'm just wondering, and currently we have a year. You know, so, I mean, what would be a reasonable window from your perspective?
Well, geez, I don't know, so much changes. I would think probably like a 30-day window would be more reasonable, because basically, I mean, you're limited by the growing season, and you try to plant first, and then you try to spray, but once you get into the growing season, you're done.
Right.
So you can't have an infinite season. And then you also sometimes have to put it off and then spray in the fall, and that's why I think a lot of times, and to give you flexibility, that's why the current period is the full calendar year, because sometimes you do fall spray and sometimes you do spring spray. But I think for any given season, you probably need to have at least a 30-day window to look at. I mean, I don't see it working any other way. And you're still going to be at the mercy of the helicopter, because helicopters are very, very expensive. And, you know, they charge, I think it's $150 to $200 an hour. And so they have to really make their time the most of it, and they really work hard.
Right. Nancy, I mean, does that make sense from your perspective?
Something like
a 30-day window?
Right, yeah, that would be so much easier to deal with for everybody, the growers and the sprayers. And
well, maybe we'll look at that then.
Okay.
So thank you both very much. Okay, so seeing no one else to testify on this bill, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 892. I'm tempted to open a work session and just pass it out, since I will see no objection, but I won't do that. Don't worry. What I'm going to do again is I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 500. I'm going to ask Lisa Arkin to come up and talk about the intention behind the bill, and then anyone who has traveled more than 100 miles to come, you know, who's signed up, or who can't come back another day very easily, be happy to take your testimony. So,
thank you,
Lisa.
Thank you, Senator Denbrough.
Yes.
For the record, my name is Lisa Arkin. Again, I'm Executive Director of Beyond Toxics. And thank you for this opportunity to discuss limitations on filing a little heard of form called the Report of Loss. So I want to first say that the purpose of the Report of Loss is to let a person who has incurred damages from a pesticide application to file a notification with the Department of Agriculture, and they have 60 days from the date of injury or when they know about the injury or the loss. The main purpose for this bill is to decouple the filing of the form in the 60-day window with the ability for them to bring a claim forward later. They will still have to file the form. They will still have the 60-day window. But like in other states, such as Washington and Idaho, the actual 60-day window is just not connected to the potential later if they need to bring their claim forward. So again, just repeat, the report of loss form will still be required and there will still be the 60-day window to turn it in. It's just not linked necessarily, and regular statute of limitations would apply. That's how it's done in Washington, Idaho, and other states. In the record, and I did bring paper copies, is the actual form itself so that the committee members could see what's required. It's pretty extensive, and you have to have a lot of information at hand to get that form filed, including, name of the operator, the landowner, their addresses, the chemicals that were sprayed, previous history of chemical use on the property, the dates, the weather, quite a lot of information. Most people have to work with a state agency to get that information, and it often takes more than 60 days. So that is the reason. We urge you to support Senate Bill 500. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Aldridge.
Senator Nimro and Chair, I support this bill, and the reason why I support this bill is because I was a victim that all these people here are saying this works. The Department of Forestry and my wife called. It took us 7 months, people, 7 months to find out what was sprayed around our place. They wanted to shoot down our paperwork because it wasn't filled out in time. Well, you got to know what the problem is. You got to know what you're signing and saying, hey, I lost this, I lost this, I lost this. If you don't know what you're sprayed with, you can't be treated for it. And I think this bill is an awesome bill. I think it needs to be upheld. If this happened to some of these other people, I think their attitude would be a little bit different. Like I said, when I first come up here earlier today, I logged all my life. I have nothing against it. I have nothing against what they're doing. But I think we need some rules and regulations for human health. My granddaughter was around my house a lot, and that little girl is sick and going to be that way with a lung issue for the rest of her life. This has affected my family personally really bad, and I would like to see these small changes. These are small changes. These people are sitting up here telling you it's a push of a button, it's this, it's that.
Thank you, Mr.
That's all I have to say.
Yeah, thank you again
thank
for
you.
Coming up. Thank you, Lisa. So since I see Lisa Hansen here, sorry, you don't want me to call you up, but I'm just going to ask you to come up and just quickly, and anyone else from the department, to let me know clearly how this program works currently. Interesting.
Welcome. For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. And with me, I have Dale Mitchell from our pesticides program. And I'm going to let him talk to you about how the report of loss form works and how we would require it and use that.
Okay. Chair Dambro and committee. Again, for the record, my name is Dale Mitchell. I'm the pesticide program manager, oversee the sales, use, and distribution of pesticides and compliance for the State of Oregon Department of Agriculture. The report of loss system is a form that an individual, when they're claiming a loss Currently, the legislation requires them to submit a written form to the agency, and it does identify a time frame, and that's so that the agency, when we receive it, we not only document the submission of the form to meet the requirements of the law, it actually provides us a time period to follow up and investigate that particular claim of loss. Now, in following up on that, our agency initiates a use investigation to document the application activity for compliance with the state regulations. We do not adjudicate the claim of loss that is left for civil action. But our investigation case file is focused on the complaint or concern being brought to our attention and our agency investigating and documenting and following up on that concern to determine compliance with the state pesticide control regulations.
And, you know, in your reading of Senate Bill 500, how would that change the way you go about doing things?
Chair Dembro, the majority of the significant change would be that no action against a landowner whom the pesticide was applied may be taken unless the party submits a report of loss to the agency within the given period of time. That is a section that in the proposal is up to be repealed.
And, you know, from your, from your perspective, and, you know, we heard a situation in which people maybe didn't know what had happened within a 60-day period. They didn't realize until after the fact that you know, they were affected by a spray because they didn't know what was sprayed, you know, et cetera. How would they be affected by this change? I mean, if they didn't know about the loss or they didn't know that they, you know, exactly what had happened to cause the dog to die or the, you know, whatever, until after the 60-day window, what happens then?
The 60 days, the way the current law is written and as far as the proposed legislation, it describes within 60 days of the date of the loss is discovered. Discovery would be based upon the complainant's acknowledgement that something has changed or something has been affected. So I really don't see much, because it goes beyond the 60 days from the date of loss is discovered.
Right. But, you know, for, you know, as an example, if, you know, just using the dog as an example, if the dog died, when does the clock start ticking? When the dog dies, or when the individual, the owner, realizes that the dog's death was triggered by some kind of misapplication that had happened?
I believe it could be either or in both situations. It's when the complainant raises the concern to the agency would be the time that the clock would start ticking.
Yes, Lisa.
Senator Dembro, for the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Ag. That's my understanding as well, is when the individual realizes that there is an issue, that they would be able to begin that process. The big difference that I see with the current law and the proposal is that no action can be taken against a landowner until the process is started. So there's a notification to the landowner or the applicator ahead of any action commencing.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you both. Okay, so I've heard that I've heard that Denver Pugh would like to testify. Thanks for your patience, Denver. Anybody else who would like to testify on this today? Okay, go ahead, Denver.
All right, thank you. Chairman Denbro, member of the committee, my name is Denver Pugh. I'm a sixth-generation farmer farming down in the Shedd area, and I strongly oppose the Senate Bill 500. I once again thank you for letting me testify against this. My strong concern about this bill would be to remove the requirement of individuals to file that report of loss before taking the legal action. On my farm, we are mainly grass seed farm production, but we also produce other seed crops such as wheat, clover, meadow foam, just to name a few. To maintain a high-quality product, I rely on spraying certain treatments on these crops. When spraying anything on my farm, pesticide use is taken very seriously, and we have policies and procedures in place to make sure we are not impacting our neighbors. For example, I monitor wind speed, wind direction. I look at my neighbor's crops to see if what I'm doing might affect them. So I look at these things. Even though these precautions in place, I still receive a complaint in the past. Without going too much detail, the complaint was driven by an organic tree shrub grower, which because of this complaint, it actually triggered a report of loss, form was filed, and it triggered an investigation by the Department of Ag. And then I was notified, and a timely investigation was done. And it's very important because the samples are collected of both parties, can engage with the agency. Well, in my case, it was really pretty simple. When I was notified, we went through the investigation process with the Department of Ag and found out that it was not chemical drift. It was natural causes. It was a hailstorm event on their trees that I was trying to get blamed on. So this was my one and only instance with the negative impact with this particular nursery. However, I did receive several phone calls from the Department of Ag on behalf of complaints on other neighboring farmers with this particular nursery. So my whole point is if it weren't for the investigation process done by the Department of Ag brought on by filing of the report of loss form, I'd be concerned that my family's farm as well as others would not have been so fortunate and would be vulnerable to frivolous lawsuits with a he said she said dispute with weak and conflicting evidence. So this is not, honestly, it's not a health issue, but it's, product. I feel for my neighbors. Like I said, I try to be real cautious, but at the same time, I'm trying to do what's right for my farm as well. So I just urge you to oppose this. Keep things out of the way they are. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Denver. Okay, anybody else who has a burning need to speak today on Senate Bill 500? You're more than welcome to come up, Ms. Peterson.
Hi, I'm Greg Peterson still. We had some experience with a alleged issue downstream of our tree farm in Soap Creek next to Corvallis. And it was claimed that this person's fish died, and he, of course, wanted to claim it on herbicides. And once again, I echo the previous comment. It was very good that the ODA and the ODF got involved in that, because it ended up that, first off, the drainage into this fish stream didn't even come off of our property. And secondly, we hadn't even started to apply any herbicides until like 2 weeks after his fish died. And so there was absolutely no connection, but it was very good that they were able to act as an intermediary, sort the facts out, look at the situation, and it ended up, I think, that his fish died because the pond was eutrophic. It had all kinds of algae on it, and basically it turned over and caused an oxygen depletion situation to happen. But to unravel that would have been horrendous for us as the landowners to actually take that on and to unravel that. Plus, you'd get all the harsh feelings back and forth with your neighbor. So I strongly reinforce the fact that ODA and Department of Forestry are very well suited to investigate those. They know the laws. They know what's supposed to be done, and they can sort the facts out. So, and otherwise, it puts a horrendous burden on us, and we are, as far as I could tell, infinitely liable for situations and for nuisance claims. And that is something that we all want to avoid, particularly as small landowners who don't have the resources to fight a nuisance claim from some organization who doesn't necessarily have the best interest, our best interest, or their best interest in mind. They're out basically to put us under. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for the information and perspective. Okay, and this will be our last piece of testimony on this. I'll talk with the proponents and organizational opponents about if we need to reschedule a date for the public hearing. Yes.
Currently, it's required to file a report of loss.
Could you again?
I'm sorry. This is Gary Hale. I live near Triangle Lake. Currently, it's a requirement to file a report of loss before filing a claim. As far as I can tell, Senate Bill 500 would remove that requirement. Instead, the report of loss would more or less just be a trigger to ODA to investigate to do a pesticide investigation. And there are not very many people in Oregon who know that. People don't tend to think after they've been sprayed, that they have to go and file a report of loss. There's a very small percentage of Oregonians who would expect that to be a requirement. And and then if you do discover afterwards that you should have filed a report of loss and now you can't, then that bars justice. There's no justice after that. So I think it's very important to decouple the requirement to file a report of loss from the ability to file a lawsuit. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, everyone, thank you for your patience. I learned a lot today, and I hope it wasn't too painful for you all to sit through this. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 500. And for today, this committee is adjourned. Actually, for this week.
Yeah.